We started out by addressing an issue that pretty closely affected every racial group in the neighborhood and every section. That was a question of drug traffic. There was a bar distributing drugs throughout the sort of centered on Kensington Avenue, right in the middle of the community, distributing drugs throughout the neighborhood. And there was a campaign that people worked on to have the place shut down and eventually demolished, which was successful and gave us a real objective basis for talking about unity to address problems.
Now, that was a case where you were actually able to involve white residents, black and Puerto Rican residents in the same effort.
Right, and it set the basis. It sort of set the context for the organizing. And so when we went to talk to people, we weren't talking out our hats. We were saying, look, this worked, right? We joined together. It was an issue that affected us all. We all saw our interest as the same, and we moved forward on it. And particularly when you're talking, let's say, in a white neighborhood to white people about working with black and Puerto Ricans, the only thing that works, at least initially, is self-interest. And you have to prove to people it's in their self-interest to unite with black and Puerto Rican folks or with any minority community. And that's sort of that's sort of a selling point. For instance, about 4 or 5 years ago, we conducted a joint campaign with residents from both sides of the east and west side of Front Street to demand a greater share of federal housing money that had come into the city. This was under the Rizzo administration. And we were successful in that campaign. And I think part of the success was that we really cut down on the city's ability to give the white community their little piece of the housing money and not give the rest of the neighborhood their piece of housing money and break people off. We approached it in a united way. It did cut down on the ability to divide and conquer, and did lay some more basis for us doing that. However, it's hard sometimes, and like sort of the racism becomes a factor in that, in the housing issue a lot because of the segregation in the neighborhood, and particularly the white community feeling like, is this an attempt to move in Puerto Rican and black people in our neighborhood? Like when we take up a housing issue in Fishtown, which is all white, that really hurts us, and the Democratic Party and the committeemen in that neighborhood make it tough on us, because that's the rumor that they spread. This is KJAC's way of integrating the neighborhood. Don't you know they're multiracial? This is what they're trying to do. We have to make an honest response to that. We're not having any intention of integrating the neighborhood, but if somebody wants to buy a house, they should buy a house. They want to buy one of these abandoned houses. They want to fix it up. It doesn't matter what color they are. You know, people have a right to live where they want to live. And that hurts us, to be quite honest.
This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Mike DeBerdinas. He's been an organizer for many years with the Kensington Joint Action Council, otherwise known as KJAC. Mike, coming off what you just said about some of the difficulties with white residents perceiving the movement of blacks and Hispanics into the neighborhood as a threat, I want to go back to something when you were describing Kensington earlier. You indicated that it had changed quite a bit. And, of course, the politics of this city have changed quite a bit, too. Kensington has the image of a white working class, politically very conservative area, and one in which there's been a lot of racial hostility. Clearly, it hasn't gone away. Do you see progress? If you looked at Kensington now as compared to 20 years ago, would you say that there is less overt racial hostility? And how would you assess the reasons for any movement there?
I think there has been progress fighting racism in Kensington. And I think we've had something to do with that. Because I'm not saying I'm going to take all the credit, but there is something to be said for creating the tone, right? Creating the political possibilities, new options for people, new ways of looking at old problems and old issues. And I think that having an organization that is genuinely black, white, and Hispanic and has brought people together, made real progress on issues of education and housing and other issues, and really shown people that this idea can work, that has made some progress. I think also people sort of in the last few years in particular really seeing when social programs were cut before it only affected the it affected primarily the minority community. Unemployment affected primarily the minority community. I think now the cuts have gotten so deep that it has, you know, and unemployment has really risen significantly in all across the country, that people now, I think, again, are looking at the problem a little differently.
Let me ask you how you got to Kensington.
Well, I grew up in Downingtown, Pennsylvania, which is a small mill town. Make a lot of paper there. They call them the paper towners or mill town. That's what they sometimes refer to the place. I was raised in a heavily Catholic and Italian family, and had to go to a Catholic school. So after I graduated high school, I went to St. Joe's College, which is in Philadelphia. And it's kind of exciting, Philadelphia and being a big city and all. And I got involved in working in the neighborhoods in Philly, worked in North Philly when I was in college and did some gang work with gangs in North Philly. And I got involved in the anti-war movement. And sort of after the anti-war movement ended, it was in the early 70s, or the war ended and the movement kind of dissipated, I was kind of looking for some rung to hang my political hat on, right, to sort of act out on all the lessons I learned in the years. And so I looked for a place that sort of gave me that option and also sort of fit into the where I grew up, you know, sort of the kind of ethnic, sort of working class sort of place where I could sort of a home away from home. And Kensington at least seemed to offer that and also had the potential. So it offered that sort of, I moved into the white, you know, white section of the neighborhood. And then it also offered sort of a expression of political view, given that it was mixed in some ways, and it was a potential to build anti-racist, multiracial organizing, also offered that opportunity too. So, and I guess it was 1973 or four, I applied for a job in the neighborhood community center, got the job, and been there ever since.
It was 1974. It's now 8 years later, right? So you came to Kensington with something of an idea, a political sense of what you'd like to see done with a community organization. Now, Kensington has a reputation of being a place where three generations of the same family might live on the same block, and that there's a sense of sort of it's a tight-knit neighborhood where people might be resistant or hostile to outsiders. What was it like to come in as someone who'd been to college and had a certain political perspective on things? Especially, you know, 74, that was during the Rizzo years.
Right. Again, like myths or stereotypes tend to have sometimes have some truth in them and sometimes don't have any truth at all. I think this sort of Kensington has sort of half and half, right? There is a certain amount of clannishness in the neighborhood. Although I think, again, I feel like it's broken down as the economic situation has gotten tougher and people moved out. You know, a lot of people moved away in the 60s and partly into the 70s. The real families, like you have some families live in the Northeast, part of the family lives in the Northeast, part of it lives in Kensington. Some of that is broken down. But there is a certain, you know, wariness of outsiders, and because of sort of just the physical nature of the neighborhood, everything's so close, everything is under so much scrutiny, you know, that the little changes are noticed. You know, somebody sweeps their sidewalk and everybody knows it. You know what I mean? It's that kind of area. You can't help. It's visual. You look out your window and you see the whole block. You see everybody. So there is this. So I think the physical, the closeness kind of creates that parochial awareness of what's happening around you. On the other hand, I've met people right away. I was working at the center, and I got very close to people, like in the course of 6 months or a year, and began to work with them about how we're going to organize, how we were going to organize this community center, and how we were going to get involved in housing issues. And I think people basically overall are kind of look at what you do. I mean, overall, people look if you're honest and look at what you do. And if you do what you say, if you put out a an idea or position, whether people agree with it or not, and they see you being honest and acting on it, that goes a long way to kind of break down that. And I think people are kind of the show me type. I think that cuts across all the neighborhoods. I mean, Black, Hispanic, white. I mean, people really want to see if you're for real. And I guess that's because of, you know, it's a tough area in some ways. And people, a lot of people have come in and out. Kind of people experimented, you know, and see if this works, see if that works. No, it didn't work. I'm moving out, you know. So there's a certain wariness of some of the leadership.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you if there's a sense that there are social workers who don't live in the neighborhood who come in with a college degree and work there for a semester or two and then leave. At some point, did you feel that it was different for you, that people saw you as somebody who was there for the long haul?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so. And I think after a few years and people see you taking chances, again, whether they agree with you or not, right? They see you taking chances. They see, you know, you sort of, again, I think also being open to learning about the area and learning about the sort of small genius that's in that neighborhood, the people's the experiences and lives. There's a lot to be learned in that area. You know, just so much to be learned, and that process of learning. From me living there is also sort of breaks down a lot of questions and fears people have, you know, and you start really, I think, bonding, like emotional bonding process happens, not just with me, but I think with all sorts of people, you know, the organization, blacks and Puerto Ricans, whites and blacks, you know, just really that whole process of organizing and working together, and the sort of emotional bond is developed.
Give me a profile of the kind of person from the neighborhood that you'd like to see drawn into KJAC.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Who we get and who I'd like to see. We get we're really short of men. It's interesting. Community work attracts a lot of women, and I think it's wonderful in the sense that we really have we don't have a male. Usually, political things are political organizations are male dominated, right? These men, you know, smoking cigars and cutting deals, right? But we have a lot of women in the organization who are in. You know, the president of KJAC's, you know, a woman. A lot of our committees are headed up by women. So that's a plus, but then it's a weakness because we don't have enough. You know, we always feel like we need more men. We need more men involved. It's a strength. Again, it's a strength and it's a weakness. On the other hand, I think who we like to see is we want to see the folks who are going to be there for a long time. We want to see the people who sort of committed to the neighborhood and who have a real sort of openness. I guess that's who we like to bring in. We'd like to bring in somebody who's open. We don't need anybody coming in who's got to have this real progressive, you know, well-developed political viewpoint. All we want is people who are open to, like, bringing their ideas in and their views of what's wrong and what's right with the neighborhood, the city, this country, and at the same time being open to new ideas, like being open to sort of novel ways and interesting approaches to old, you know, and longstanding problems.
When you came to the neighborhood, you came to a place where clearly there was a political structure already at work and interests already in place. Now, Philadelphia has a tradition of what some would call machine politics, by which if you're in a neighborhood, the way you get services taken care of is through your committee person who answers to a ward leader, who answers to a council person, and that there's a party structure. That's what tends to that may tend to control elections, and it will also tend to control the flow of services back to the neighborhood, whether it's trash collection or getting a lot cleaned. As you went into that, you must have in some way rubbed up against that existing political structure. I mean, I know Councilman Harry Giannotti is...
Hates us.
He hates you, right?
He's no longer a councilman, by the way. So.
Right, former Councilman Harry Giannotti. Well, let's take that as a case of how you interacted, to use a sort of antiseptic term, with an existing political structure. When did you first decide he hated you? When did he first decide he hated you?
It's interesting. You know, it's my belief that whole process, right, that whole – you talk to your committee man, he's going to get the thing taken care of. He'll run it up the ladder, right? He'll run it up the party ladder and he'll come back, then everything's fine. Well, excuse me, that may have worked you know, 20 years ago, 25, 30 years ago, when the problems in the inner city didn't quite have the edge that they have now. The contradictions, at least within the city, weren't as clear. I mean, there wasn't as much. The issues tended to be who's going to, you know, I got to get my traffic ticket fixed. I need a no parking sign in front of my house. Who's going to get the baskets out at Christmas time? You know, and maybe now, there was some jobs. You know, there was sort of people really rooted in were getting jobs, right? But look at unemployment now. We're talking about 12-15% unemployment, right? So there's not enough jobs to go around anymore to keep people happy. The questions move from parking tickets to hundreds and hundreds of abandoned houses. The question moved from, well, can you get these kids off my corner, to how are we going to stop the drug traffic? So the questions have become, have really begun to mirror, I think, the broader, you know, broader questions facing the country. You know, they really become magnified. So what's the committeeman going to do? You know, what's he going to do about the asbestos in infesting two or three of the local schools? What's the committeeman going to do about the three or four abandoned houses on your block? What's he going to do about the bank that's redlining your neighborhood? He's not going to do anything. And probably the councilman is not going to do anything either, because they're tough issues. And sometimes they're harder to deal with they're harder to deal with than to let go. Just let them ride and try to posture like you're dealing with them, right? Posture like you're dealing with them. That structure, that way of doing things don't work anymore. And I think people are beginning to realize that. And again, you get back to your earlier thing about people openness to working together with different folks and getting in organizations. That changed. That's changing. That's part of why that's changing. But so when a group comes up, right, when an organization, residents getting together to say, we're gonna get this problem taken care of, and we're gonna do what we can. We're gonna meet with anything we have to do to get it taken care of. We'll go talk to our councilman, and we'll talk to the mayor, and we'll talk to the managing director, and we'll talk to the state representative. And if they can't handle it or unwilling to handle it, then we'll push it further. Right? We'll take it further. And again, that's a threat to anybody who's in political office, because then who delivers the goods? Who delivers the services? It ain't them, right? It's not them doing it. It's the people in the neighborhood getting it done, jumping over them, right? Running around them, going through them to get the service, to get the change. And that's power. I mean, that's the bottom line. That's what we're talking about, a struggle for power, right?
Now, I understand that in this particular case that you mentioned a while ago of abandoned houses, mm-hmm. and acquiring abandoned houses for needy families who are willing to move in them and right. develop them. Councilman Gennady had been involved in a program previously there, and you clashed horns with him.
Right. He was running the program. He was running this program that took houses in and turned them over to people. But it was after we investigated it, he was giving them to his friends and his committee men, and there was a lot of patronage involved in the program, only serving a certain element of the community. And our view was that shouldn't happen, that program should not be politicized, that it should run on a sort of fair and equal basis. So we tried to meet with him, and he said, I'm not going to meet with you people, you know, I'm not to do with you. What was our option? But the campaign to have that program taken out of his hands, which we did effectively. And after we did that, then we moved into increasing production in the program. You know, ways, okay, now it's out of his hands. How are we going to get more houses in the hands of the people? So then we moved beyond that. And yeah, we rubbed up against him. And I'm not ashamed to say that we're out to be as powerful as we can, to do as much as we can to basically advance the interest of the poor and working class people in that neighborhood. And we rub up all kinds of people, banks, corporations, elected officials, right? Presidents of hospitals. I mean, it's a whole range of people. And essentially, it's a class rub there. I mean, you know, it's a lot of times we know our interests are not the same as, let's say, for instance, St. Christopher's Hospital, which wants to leave the neighborhood because they're losing a little money. Now, our interest is not the same as the board of directors' interest. They want to make money. We want to provide quality medical care for the neighborhood. They're divergent interests. The only thing that's going to change that situation is political power. Who has the most political power? That's what's going to change the situation. If we can organize and have more political power, force or bring in allies from the elected officials, bring in other institutions backing us, bring in the neighborhood people, you know, to make it a kind of issue that people are going to say, well, maybe they should stay. Well, they're going to stay if we're able to do that. If we're not, then they're going to leave because their interests are not the same as the neighborhood's interest. Quality medical care for people in the community. So over and over again, that little scenario gets played over and over and over again in housing, education. And so, again, that's a part of our organizing that we really try to make people see.
You said a moment ago that one of the key ingredients in articulating the interest of the neighborhood is political power. And I want to turn to that question because I know that about a year ago, after organizing in the neighborhood for many, many years, on both sides of the ethnic track, so to speak, in Kensington, and being, I think, successful at least in some measures in doing it, you made an attempt to run for a small political office. Tell us that story.
Yeah. Well, over the years, people began to see there's real limits to issue organizing. Now, it's funny. I started talking about how you learn. You get in these processes and you learn from the people around you, right? My view was the political system stinks. It's corrupt. You know, all these guys are just, you know, they're all, they're all bought off and, you know, everybody owes everybody else and you really got your hands tied and you can't do anything. I think that's a common view pretty much held across large segments of the population that all politicians are crooked. It's hard to be an honest politician, that kind of thing. But people were sort of saying, look, you know, that's where the power is. Now, we can do all this issue work, right? We can fight for a new high school. We can fight for better housing, right? But what if we were in these decision-making positions, right? What if we, as, you know, were accountable to the people in this neighborhood, ran the campaigns based on the interests of this neighborhood, based on platforms, really democratically, you know, real democratically structured platforms growing out of the concerns of this community? Well, you know, that's we're missing an important element in our work, right? And began to say, hey, yeah, that makes sense, right? And there is, you know, there is a potential for that. And so out of that idea that the issue work is important and lays the groundwork for launching an attempt at getting into the political arena. So we established what we called the Independent Political Action Committee, and I was chosen to be a candidate for the state representative seat in the 180th district. So we ran a campaign, I mean, which on a lot of levels was very, very successful, and on some levels, particularly the vote count, was not as successful as we had hoped, but successful enough that it had really advanced the work. And I can talk about that if you like.
Well, I'm curious about you're thinking about why the vote counts came out as they did, because this is clearly a case of where you weren't just somebody who had another idea, but somebody who'd really been working quite a long time to make yourself known. And why do you think that it was hard to translate that recognition as a community organization into votes?
Okay, it's a complicated area as we found out in the campaign. First of all, I mean, when you look at by election standards, right? You got to look at what was the field like? Well, there was two incumbents who had gotten reapportioned into the same district, two white incumbents.
A fairly traditional Democratic.
Yeah, straight Democratic. Rizzo, you know, really attached to Rizzo, right? And then it was a Puerto Rican candidate who was sort of, our view was that he was used to cut into our vote. That was our perspective, that we would do well in the Hispanic community. They needed somebody to run to play to Puerto Rican nationalism. Right, and to attract minority votes away from a white candidate, right? So then, and there was myself, right? So it was a big field, two very strong white candidates who had ties. As it turned out, all the ward leaders, right, went with the one candidate who was the eventual winner. All the ward leaders are connected in that area, connected with Frank Rizzo, and they're all established and still control vast number of votes, right? I mean, so. That was the other thing, that the Democratic structure in there is highly organized, around vote getting, around bringing out the vote and all that. So we were up against that. And the third thing is our inexperience. I mean, the way the election went down, just to give people an idea how it went down, it was like the winner got 2,800 votes, the second person got 22, and me and this Hispanic candidate both came in around 1,500, more or less around 1,500 votes. Now, our weaknesses were basically, I think, our inexperience. I mean, we registered a lot of people. We had a big voter registration drive. We registered 1,500 people and didn't know how to get them out. You know what I'm saying? We learned.
You mean the mechanics of running an election were new to you?
Oh, very new to me. I mean, I was involved in, you know, various – all of us were involved in various political campaigns, but, on a lower level in terms of poll watchers or, canvassing, things like that. But it never structured a campaign that number one – put out the issues in a consistent way. Number two, tried to touch every part of the area. Number three, had to deal with divisions. And, number four, had to deal with getting out the vote. How do you bring out the vote after you register them? We did a great job registering people. And then, when it came down to the last week of the election, we spent, as we saw afterwards, we didn't spend enough time getting the folks who we registered, targeting the people who we knew were going to vote for me and for our platform to get them out.
So you don't think the fact that that you lost to one of these more traditional Democratic candidates indicates that old system of patronage, services through committee people and ward leaders will still hold sway over an active community organization? That's the sort of...
I think in the long run, I think we're going to be able to become a serious political influence. Or not KJAC, but, they're linked because some of the people are saying, but the Independent Political Action Committee and sort of grassroots organizations that are moving into the political arena right now, in the next 10 years in this city are going to be a significant political force. And it's already happening right now.
Already happening in what way?
In the Wilson Good, Frank Rizzo campaign for mayor right now.
Well, let's look at that. I was going to ask you that as someone who knows Kensington, and Kensington being thought of probably by a lot of people as a traditional Rizzo area. How do you see that at this point? How does the race look there?
Well, as far as we're concerned, it looks pretty good. I mean, we've got
pretty good, G-O-O-D, G-O-O-D-E. I mean, oh. Wilson good or good.
Well, it looks encouraging. We've had like a series of coffee clutches for Wilson Good in Fishtown and white neighborhoods where every coffee clutch we've had 40, 50 people attending, right? That we were surprised. We were really glad to see that. People are coming out. People are curious. They want to see this, they want to see this candidate. We think that he has that's encouraging. This is more on an organizational basis. I'm not talking about the issues and the politics. Secondly, we've registered right now close to 3,500 people. We still have 3 or 4 weeks to go to the close of registration. That's the single largest voter registration drive ever in that part of the city. We've had rallies where we had up to 400 people at neighborhood rallies for him. I think we're talking primarily about a white and a Puerto Rican community and not a black community. Primarily, when you link them two together, you're talking about 85% of the neighborhood. We think that there's based on our work, that Mr. Good has a very good chance of winning sizable vote plurality in the Puerto Rican neighborhood, and he's going to keep down Rizzo's margin, we think, in the white areas, the river wards.
I'm interested in your feel for what the degree of support or the enthusiasm for Rizzo's support in white ethnic row house neighborhoods. Is it like 1974?
It's not like the charter change, and it's not like 74. I'm saying is, at least from my view of it, is right now, we haven't seen their people on the streets. We haven't seen a whole lot of signs and posters up. There hasn't been a whole lot of debate. You know what I mean? Like, we were around, go to meetings and stuff. It's not happening in the river wards as the way, like around the charter change. I mean, the place was popping. You could feel it. It's in the air, 1979.
Why? What's the difference?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to assess. Sort of, it's only something's happening for a couple of weeks, or you're looking for it to happen, and it's hard to tell. I can make some guesses, you know, and guesses can be right or wrong. I think the Reaganomics has had a real sobering effect on people. You know what I mean? And they're not so sure if, you know, about sort of conservative, you know, sort of white politics is the one that's going to help them. I think that's part of it. I think that Rizzo, because of the strength of the minority community in this town, is political clout that it has developed over the past few years, has been unable to play to the blatant, you know, racist overtures, you know, make these blatant racist overtures. He can't do it. He's handcuffed. I think he's gone crazy because he must be gone crazy because he can't go back to that well, because that well ain't there anymore since the charter changed. So that's a very, you know, I think that's a real sort of, so the people who tend to gravitate to that, you know, aren't out there, you know, pumping up. He can't do it. His advisor told him it's a political liability to talk about vote white, you know, bring back, well, I stopped Whitman Park, I stopped Edison High School, you know, I'm going to stop crime, I'm going to keep the blacks in check. I mean, that message just isn't going down anymore. You know, when I talked about the good campaign, like I sort of said, it's happening. Now, you asked me a question about, well, what do you mean it's happening? Like I said, the neighborhood movement. Is that the good campaign is fundamentally depending on neighborhood institutions, organizations, and structure. That essentially, I think, in a big way, not that they're bypassing their Democratic Party support that they have, but it ain't enough, and they know it. It's not enough. So what they're doing now is they're depending on the organizations like our Independent Political Action Committee to do the work in significant parts of the city, parts of North Philadelphia, parts of Kensington, West Kensington, you know, lower North Philadelphia, in areas where there's the strong Rizzo organization. They have to get their own organization in there. And essentially they're depending on the already existing, neighborhood, you know, political with, a small P, structures in the community. And it's exciting. And I think what you're seeing, what that is not just a reflection of the need of the good campaign to get that alternative, to find that alternative structure. That's in part, but what it is a reflection, I think, of the last 10 years of organizing in the city. So, you know, I mean, it's not just a good campaign need, it's also that there's something there for them to go to. And it's and to that point that in the last, I think, the last 10 years, the neighborhood movement and the sort of self-generated, mass-based organizations have really become a force. Where there's some political power, there's some troops, there's some sense of purpose that's there and that have to be recognized.
And that's happened in other places besides Kensington?
Oh, yeah, North Philly. I mean, there's a North Philadelphia office that sprung out of some, you know, some leaders up there established, and I know groups like ACORN have been really working very closely with the Good Campaign, and people from all sorts of organizations that we're familiar with and we've worked with are in that campaign, and they are separate in most ways from the Democratic Party, so they're becoming an influence in the electoral arena. And then after the election, you're talking about goods and services, right? Who's going to get the goods and services, and who's going to be able to influence the direction of policy and the flow of services is hopefully going to be us, right? You know, hopefully we're going to be able to influence more, you know, benefit more people in the community and break up some of this concentration of power and money.
Briefly, after 8 years in Kensington as a community organizer, it can't be a 9-to-5 job, I know. The pay can't be that good. Are there moments that you wonder if it's worth it?
Well, there's moments that I don't want to be around. I just like to sort of be sitting on the beach somewhere. You know, I mean, I want to get away from, I think me and my wife sort of at nights, you know, like it's, the kids are in bed and, you know, it's like 10 o'clock and, you know, sort of the day started at 6:30 and it's like 10 o'clock and, you know, maybe one of us went to a meeting and the other one was on the phone trying to get the kids a bath and stuff. That you just want to get away. You just want to sort of forget about it for a little while. What
are the moments that make it worth it?
I'm just saying, the basic, though, I was going to continue, is that the basic the basic feeling is that I think personally, I sort of have this belief that what we're doing is significant to the city, in the sense that we're talking about fighting racism, right? Empowering folks in to deal with problems in their neighborhood, attempting to like build a real substantial electoral political base, right? That work is important, it's exciting, and eventually I think have a serious and long term impact on the city of Philadelphia, and linked up with movements around the country that are talking about, you know, jobs for peace, which we're involved in, movements that are stopping, you know, fighting our intervention in El Salvador, which again we have a committee on, which I didn't even talk about, movements around, affirmative action, where people, you know, anti-nuclear movement, where people are really trying to take in charge of what's happening around them, right, and not giving that up anymore, and sort of some of the rebirth in the labor movement, to say that we're to feel like in both real ways and also in more of a, for lack of a better word, a sort of a spiritual way, that we're part of that movement is sort of what sort of, and the belief that that movement is going to really turn things around in this country eventually, is what sort of fuels my fires. You know, and what I think fuels the fire, and I think this an important ingredient of our work, people really see themselves in the organization as being part of a movement, you know, and that's exciting.